The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. On our last program, we began a discussion of what perhaps is the most unusual phylum of the invertebrate animals, and that was the echinoderms, the starfish. They include the sea feathers and sea lilies and the sea cucumbers, including some very unusual ones, the sand dollars, the crinoids, just completely different, almost completely different from all the other forms of life. And we made some comments about that, and I had ended the program by quoting a section out of the text that we use in our invertebrate zoo courses, text entitled Integrated Principles of Zoology by Hickman, Roberts, and Larson. And in the introduction to the chapter on echinoderms, this was the comment that the authors of the textbook had made. Let me repeat it for you, please. The distinguished American zoologist Libby Hyman once described the echinoderms as a noble group especially designed to puzzle the zoologist. And the latter phrase there was simply a quote from Dr. Hyman. With a combination of characteristics that should delight the most avid reader of science fiction, the echinoderms would seem to confirm Lord Byron's observation that the strange but true for truth, tis strange but true, for truth is always strange, stranger than fiction. And if human beings were going to set out to design organisms, I doubt if any of them would end up like the starfish. Now, the unusual characteristics that are there are simply part of the problem from an evolutionary standpoint. Presumably, the organisms that we see today, the echinoderms in particular, have been derived at some point in the past from some kind of common ancestor. And as I commented last time on the program, even if you have, if you're trying to connect the organisms in the classes in the phylum, you have a very interesting task because there's some unbelievably diverse characteristics. And when it comes to trying to connect this phylum to any other, the annelids that we have just finished talking about, or the arthropods, annelids, of course, being such things as earthworms and leeches, and arthropods being any of those organisms that have external shells, exoskeletons. Was there a common ancestor from those, or were all of these derived from some other common ancestor, which is usually the tack that the evolutionist takes? And as we have observed often, if this were true, if this notion that the organisms which we see today and all their variety must have been descendant from some common ancestors, then that necessitates some evidence based on the presence of the common ancestors. And if you think about this carefully, there really ought to be more common ancestors or intermediate species or missing links, and all of those terms are simply synonyms. There ought to be more of them than there are the organisms. There ought to be a history of remnants of organisms that are intermediate, going from one kind of organism to another. And we've talked about that idea previously, and I won't repeat all of that. But it still is a point worth noting. And the fact is that any freshman zoology student worth his salt can put probably 90% or more of the fossils we find into their proper phylum. Now, if the evolutionists were right about this, there ought to be remnants left from all of the history of the organisms through the history of the Earth that were intermediate, that were changing from one thing into another. It'd be very difficult to know whether they were one-tenth of the way developed from one organism to another, or half, or three-fourths, or whether they're actual organisms themselves. And this idea is particularly pertinent when we're looking at the echinoderm, starfish, and the associated organisms that are here. And the observation then is quite true. A noble group especially designed to puzzle the zoologist. if you are unwilling to accept the idea that God created the organisms and the starfish included, then you have some tremendous difficulties trying to connect them with anything else. I mentioned on the last program there is one thing in particular. I would expect most evolutionists to argue that the starfish had evolved from bilateral animals. The word bilateral simply means two-sided, and more properly, probably, the ability to be divided into left and right halves. Your body, if you are a human, is bilateral. You have a right and left side. You could draw a line down through the middle of your body and end up with reasonably mirror-like images. Now, you look at the starfish, and the common ones, as we mentioned, and as you are, I'm sure some of you have seen, have five appendages. Now, how in the world do you get an organism with five appendages from one which has been bilateral, right and left-sided? Well, there certainly is not any apparent reason to do that. By the way, that arrangement with five legs or more is what is known as radial symmetry. Radial symmetry means that you can divide an organism into more than one mirror image. If an organism is bilateral, as people are, then you can divide them in the middle into right and left. If you have a starfish, then you could divide those into five mirror images, and so on. Now, why would the evolutionist, and I think this would be the major voice from them, argue that these radial animals with five appendages, or 12, or 24 in some cases, why would they argue that these things have come from bilateral ancestors? And the answer to that simply has to do with the fact that the larval stages are all bilateral. So you have a very interesting change here in the life history of the starfish. It starts out as a very interesting looking little bilaterally divided, bilaterally symmetrical organism that looks absolutely nothing like the adults are going to. I happen to be looking at some pictures here of some of those. This, by the way, was the reason that early classification got into some difficulties. If you had a zoologist, a curious one, that was poking around in the ocean someplace, he could find the starfish, but he could also find some very interesting-looking little flat things that are bilaterally symmetrical. And there is no way in the world he would connect the immature stages of the starfish with the adults. So it would have been a difficulty back then, and it still, to my mind, is a difficulty. I'm not arguing over the fact that the immature stages are bilateral. My argument has to do with the fact that you would not predict that such immature stages would produce the adults that are here, that we see. And while we're talking about that, at least give some thought to the difficulty of some kind of mysterious evolutionary process that would change bilaterally symmetrical, two-sided immature stages into radial adults that can be divided into many, many images. And it is not a conclusion you would push unless you were trying to support a rather strange notion of organisms coming from common ancestors, or you were trying to provide some kind of evidence for the theory of evolution. Let me go on in the textbook here. It's a couple of comments that are probably worth noting. Despite the adaptive value of bilaterality, what's being said here, the adaptive value in the evolutionist mind, if an organism develops a helpful characteristic that confers adaptability onto the organism, and the more that have that, the more that will be formed from them, and the more helpful the characteristic is, the more it will aid in adaptation. And being bilateral, having a right and left side, as most of the vertebrates do, dogs or cats or horses or whatever, this provides a fairly easy way of moving around from one place to another, among other things. So this is the kind of things being referred to here. Despite the adaptive value of bilaterality for free-moving animals, and the merits of radial symmetry for sessile animals. Now, sessile animals are animals that don't move around very much. Sea cucumber would be an example of this in this phylum. They can move. They can be swept around with the tides or whatever, but they usually simply attach themselves at some point and remain there for some length of time. Now, the bilateral characteristic is great for moving around, but it's really not particularly helpful for staying in one place. And the sessile structure, sea cucumbers look very much like the vegetable from which they're named. This is not going to provide any reasonably good method of getting around from one place to another. So you simply have that apparent contradiction present in organisms in the phylum. Despite the adaptive value of bilaterality for free-moving animals and the merits of radial symmetry for sessile animals, echinoderms confounded the rules by becoming free-moving but radial. Now, I don't want to put too much into what was said here, but the statement would imply that somehow the starfish were intelligent enough to be able to overcome these difficulties themselves and somehow take advantage of both of these types of symmetry. And I am not willing to grant to an organism, an animal, that kind of intelligence. And again, this is something we've talked about before. If you will analyze the difficulty faced by the evolutionists, there really is a twofold problem. Number one, the organisms have to be able to understand the difficulty. And then they also have to be able, number two, to tinker with their genetic material in such a way that they can solve whatever the particular problem has to be. So the statement here would imply that not only are the echinoderms organisms with very interesting characteristics, but they're also immensely intelligent because they were able to combine two characteristics, two types of body structure, which are not normally combined, and were able to do that in such a way that they have become very, very successful animals. Now, again, we're not arguing about the fact that they're here. I am arguing against the notion that somehow the primitive echinoderms had the intelligence and or the ability to interfere with their genetic material in such a way that they were able to change things around until they were able to survive in a particular environment with great ease. Now, that line of thinking simply represents an unbelievable leap in validity or reasonableness. There is certainly no evidence that would suggest that the echinoderms, interesting though they are, had the ability of that sort.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson @bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.